Good morning. Good morning. Bonjour. I'm going to talk about my own story a little bit and then kind of move into an analysis of race relations in America. As you know from the conversation earlier, I'm an ethnographer. What that means is that I study people up close. I listen to them, observe them, take notes, spend time with them, and then try to apprehend, comprehend, understand, and then represent who they are, how they live, the way of life. And when one does ethnography, one's own story is always important, always important. The way one has come to live himself, herself, story, one's own story. I was born on a plantation in the South during the war, World War II. My grandmother was the midwife when I was born. Black people often didn't go to hospitals until they were ready to die. It was a tremendous amount of segregation in America at that time. And black people, of course, were segregated. See? My mother picked cotton. My father picked cotton. My grandparents picked cotton. My dad fought in the war, World War II, came to Europe, and spent time in a segregated unit in England and in France. When he returned to the U.S., he couldn't live in the South anymore. He couldn't take the abuse, couldn't live as a second-class person so well there, thinking that either he would be hurt or maybe he would hurt someone else. At the same time, the factories in the North beckoned to many black people. And my father migrated the family to Chicago, South Bend, Indiana. He worked in a factory in South Bend, Studebaker's. Studebaker's. He worked in the foundry there, as many black people did. Very tough job, very tough job. He had a limited education, fourth grade, but made a very decent living. In that year, maybe $5,000, $5,200 a year, which may not seem like a lot of money today, but in fact, in today's money, maybe about $40,000 a year, $50,000 a year, with no education and no skills. He and so many other black working class people, white people too, made decent livings in the factory of that day and time. My mother worked as a domestic. She did housework for well-to-do white people, along with many other black women of that day and time. South Bend is located about 90 miles east of Chicago. When I was growing up there, the population was 125,000. The black population was about 8%. 8%. And many of the black people who lived there were people who were recent migrants from the South. And these people joined previous migrants who were, at that point, better established. They were merchants. They owned property. They went to middle-class churches, black middle-class churches oftentimes. And people like my parents who came in to the city during the 40s and late 50s were oftentimes newcomers who had to be socialized and brought in by the established blacks. So you see, within the black community, there was a class system that was to some extent related to who'd come when, you see. Well, I was raised in this community, and I attended segregated schools. In the third grade, I was reading on a sixth grade level. And my teacher had me read to other kids, which didn't make friends for me sometimes, you know. And I remember feeling like an outsider and to some extent trying to play catch up in order to be a part of the group, but that took a lot of effort and work. And eventually I blended in and eventually played sports, went on to high school, and eventually got turned on to college. By 1965, America was beginning to boil. The inner cities in this country were beginning to boil. The civil rights movement had begun. People like Martin Luther King spoke and encouraged people. People demonstrated. The Freedom Riders were all over the South. There were demonstrations. There were water hoses throughout the country being used against black people wanting to vote. This made nationwide news. It made international news. And the civil rights struggle that King led culminated in riots all over the country between 1964 and 1968. City after city after city in the U.S. burned. Beginning with Watts, California, it burned. Reno, Nevada, it burned. Salt Lake City, Utah, it burned. Springfield, Illinois, it burned. Chicago, it burned. Detroit, it burned. South Bend, my hometown, there were riots there. No. And you move east to Cleveland, it burned. Harlem, New York, it burned. Boston, it burned. Washington, D.C., it burned. Baltimore, it burned. Atlanta, Georgia, it burned. Cities all over the country between 1964 and 1968, these cities burned. They had riots. They had riots. And this was in the middle of the Cold War, when we in America were pushing the idea that we had the best system. At the same time, the Soviet Union was saying, we have the best system. So there was competition. And the debate went, well, you can't be a democracy because you don't let black people vote. And so people like John Kennedy and Johnson and others and various politicians wanted to make America, America. and they began to listen, and they began to change things. Certain legislation allowed black people voting rights, public accommodations, and various other advances were made. Now, mind you, at this moment in history, black people were highly, highly segregated. Highly segregated. All over the country, north and south. North and south. In fact, you could go back to slavery and think about slavery with respect to the riots, slavery with respect to the segregation that was occurring in the towns that period in time, and think about the ways in which slavery itself established black people's place at the very bottom of the social order. When black people migrated to cities, they were contained in ghettos, giving rise to the iconic ghetto, the construct that says black people belong here in the ghetto. And now these ghettos were beginning to explode because people wanted to be treated with full rights, obligations, and duties of American citizenship. But they found this proposition wanting. And the leaders were calling attention to these contradictions, you see. And people like Lyndon Johnson and John Kennedy, in part, I believe, encouraged by the Cold War, wanted to make America America. And they began to try to cool out these riots, you see, to cool them out, to appease people, to give people a stake in the system. And so what you have then is a period of racial incorporation, affirmative action, set-asides. Their project was to build a new black middle class that was not simply dependent upon the ghetto and its structures, but to bring black people into the wider society. And so what we had was this incredible incorporation process. What this meant was that black people were being moved into the wider society. A black middle class was growing. Black people began to attend formerly white schools, universities, began to work in white workplaces, began to live in white neighborhoods. I'm a part of that process of racial incorporation. Today, the city, not just Philadelphia, but many other American cities, can be conceptualized in terms of white space, black space, and racially mixed space. Over my career, I've been writing ethnographically about the black space. You can read about the black space by reading my work, A Place on the Corner, a study of black street corner men. I hung out for 3 years on one street corner with these men and wrote about them in my book, A Place on the Corner, which is used in college classes all over the country right now, today. Or you can read my book, Streetwise, which is all about life in the ghetto versus life in a gentrifying neighborhood in Philadelphia. Or you can read my book, Code of the Street, which is all about the black space, as it were. Concerned with why so many young people in these communities are literally killing each other, shooting, killing each other out of alienation, you see. In that book, in these works, I talk about this history that I've just mentioned. But I also talk about deindustrialization. The fact that just as black people were being incorporated into the system, we have a process of deindustrialization. And jobs, working class jobs, jobs like those my father worked in, we could make a decent living with no skills and no education. Those jobs went literally out to sea. They went to non-metropolitan America. They went to the suburbs. They went to Mexico. They went to China. See? And they left this powerful, powerful employment vacuum in the inner city. And the jobs that were left became more complicated. In order to do those jobs, perform those jobs, you needed not only human capital, that is, skills and education, but you also needed social capital, that is, people in the workplace who were receiving of you, you see. And black people, because of this history, the racial history in America, are very oftentimes not well received in the workplace, not well received in the suburbs, not well received in the larger society. Why? In part because it goes back to slavery. A lot of people believe that black people belong in the black space. The black space. So as people move about in the society through the incorporation process, yes, many people have been receptive. Many people of the wider society have been receptive. But many, many have not. And so black people are told no, 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 again and again and again for jobs. Or when they move into jobs, they're scrutinized. When they move from the ghetto into the larger society, they're oftentimes met with a deficit of credibility, a deficit of credibility. See? And the deficit of credibility has nothing to do, oftentimes, with one's qualifications, one's merit. It has everything to do with the black person's skin color, you see, and his or her connection to the black space. The problem is the person is not white, you see. Because the white person does not have this deficit of credibility as he or she navigates the larger society. But the black person does. This is what we're dealing with right now today in America. Yes, we have a black middle class in America that is larger than at any time in American history. This is a wonderful achievement, a wonderful accomplishment. At the same time, we have the iconic ghetto. We have people who are disenfranchised by the exodus of jobs and opportunities. People who are on their own, trying to make it any way they can. But the jobs have gone out to sea. So what we have is persistent urban poverty in so many places in the United States. A question is, how do people cope with this persistent urban poverty? Well, there are three prongs that undergird the inner city economy at ground zero. One source of income is welfare, or what's left of it. Another source of income is the set of low-wage jobs, service occupations that don't pay people enough money to live. A third element is the irregular underground economy at ground zero. And these three prongs, they intersect, they interact with one another, you see, within that community. They circulate money within the community, you see. And of course, in the inner city poor community, in the black space, all these transactions are going on. Exchange, bartering, hustling, begging, and street crime. These various elements interact, but without the benefit of civil law. The civil law in the inner city community has eroded over time. And so a code of the street operates, you see, the code of the streets, which relies chiefly on respect. Respect. Or street credibility. So that if a person is violating you or likely to violate you or your family, you have to let that person know in no uncertain terms that he or she cannot get away with that. You don't call the police. The police are considered not to be your friend. You deal with them yourself because street credibility is everything. And street credibility within the community is high maintenance. You can't have it once and for all. It has to be established and reestablished all the time. This is one of the reasons why the crime rate is so high, the violence rate is so high. Because given the isolation and the segregation, the community operates without the benefit of civil law. The civil law has eroded, you see. Now, mind you, this is the black space, quote unquote, and the wider system has oftentimes abdicated its responsibility to the black space. The middle class blacks oftentimes live beyond the ghetto, oftentimes in the white space, or a space that used to be white. Because as soon as the black people move in to the larger society, the white people often flee, or they shun them on the streets of the local community, assuming that these black people are not middle class, that these black people belong in the black space, you see, because these black people have the deficit of credibility. And so, as a black person moves about in that larger society, one of his or her burdens is to work to disabuse the white people and others of the notion that the ghetto stereotypes apply to him or her, you see. So that means you have to perform. You have to dance, as some people say, presenting yourself in such a way that people will think that the ghetto stereotypes do not apply to you, you see? And this is how people move about in the white space, the larger society, and they're checked and scrutinized and observed. People look for problems with the person. Just as Marcus was saying with respect to shopping while black, driving while black, walking while black, you see. And the problem here is the tension between the larger society or the white space and the iconic ghetto. The iconic ghetto and the white space. Two very important concepts here. Also important is the concept of the cosmopolitan canopy. You see. My book by that name was published in 2012. And this is the racially mixed space. Just to remind you, I indicate that there are three types of spaces in the city today. The black space, which I wrote about in these other books, and then the racially mixed space, the cosmopolitan canopy, you see. This island of civility, this diverse island of civility, located in a sea of racial segregation. Under the canopy, it's time out, it's civil, people are nice, pleasant to each other across racial lines. They don't go very deep sometimes, but they're civil to one another, if you follow me. And then, of course, there's the white space itself where you don't see any black people at all. Very few. And see, black people who navigate the canopy, the cosmopolitan canopy, and the canopy is really a metaphor for civil society. For civil society. It's what you run into downtown. It's what you run into in the larger civil spaces of the city, you see, diverse as they are, where people are nice to each other, you see. In these places, you feel, oh, this is very pleasant. Oh. But once in a while, as a black person, you run into this moment of acute disrespect. And it's shocking because you're not used to that. You don't expect it under the canopy. A moment of acute disrespect. And the source of that has a lot to do with the iconic ghetto. Because this is what you represent as a black person, the iconic ghetto. Until you dance by wearing a tie, by wearing a suit, by speaking educated English, by being nice, you see. And so you think that under the canopy you don't have these problems. So when you have this moment of acute disrespect, it is so alarming, so shocking. You see. And black people call this the nigger moment. The nigger moment. That's what they call it. That moment of acute disrespect based on your blackness. And you don't expect it under the canopy. Because the canopy is civil society, you see. That island of civility in a sea of racial segregation. Now, the white space, you expect to have the nigger moment. So you are very wary. You walk about carefully, you see. You know, you don't trust that environment so much. But the civil spaces, you've learned to trust these spaces. You've learned to take white people at their word. You've learned to be friends with white people. And most people get along, of course. But once in a while, you can run into the nigger moment there, and it's shocking. Because in the white space itself, people expect that moment. And so they're very careful. They watch their back. They drive slowly as they move through the white space. All the white people are honking at you, go faster, but you know you hold on to your will and you go drive because you know you're being profiled. You see, you're under scrutiny, like being in jail. You see, that's what it's like to be in the white space as a black person. And see, the white space itself gives rise to the notion that black people do not belong here. And black people understand that the white space, and it is a perceptual category, that the white space is off limits to black people. You understand that, you see. But you're hoping to navigate that space. Why? Because that's where the rewards are. That's where the nice restaurants are. That's where education is. That's where the jobs are. And that's where the hope of acceptance lies. Do you see? This is the situation that we live with in America today. And this is all, what I'm telling you is based on my ethnographic work. From A Place on the Corner to Streetwise to Code of the Street to the Cosmopolitan Canopy. All of this is documented in these ethnographic works. And my new work, the one I'm working on right now, is called The Iconic Ghetto. And this is the tension between the white space and the black space that every black person is dealing with in America. No matter what your class position, you can be the president of the United States, and you are dealing with that tension between, on the one hand, the white space and the iconic ghetto, and to get beyond and to live like a real human being, you've got to perform or dance and show that the ghetto stereotypes do not apply to me. And if you can do that, you can pass inspection for a while because you have a provisional status. You're on probation in the white space. You see? One might argue that the White House is the white space. So a black occupant is on probation. The university, unfortunately, we're on probation. I'm a professor. I'm a student. I'm a janitor. In the white space, I'm on probation. Provisional status, unfortunately. And what that means is that you have something to prove. That's what it means to have provisional status, if you follow me. It isn't that one can't prove it. It's just that it takes so much work to prove it all the time. And in this space, there are wonderful, wonderful white people. People who love black people. People who embrace black people. But there are also white people who hate your guts. And your problem as a black person is you can't always tell which is which. You see? Of course, the same thing might be said for a black person navigating the black space. You know there are good black people there. But you know there are bad black people there, but you can't tell which is which. So that's what the tension is with this new book that I'm working on. And the iconic ghetto, and that tension hovers over American race relations today. No matter what your class position, if you have black skin, you run into this problem, you see. I'll stop there. We have a few videos that we can show that will illuminate some of the points I've made. And I'm not going to put these up for discussion so much, but I think it's important just for you to see and draw your own conclusions, you see, based on what I've been saying, but also based on the essay that we had you read, The White Space, and the other one, The Iconic Ghetto. And I might add, you might read my book, The Cosmopolitan Canopy, the last chapter of which is The Nigger Moment. Again, it's in quotes because this is what people say. I'm not trying to say this myself, but the nigger moment, that moment of acute disrespect based on one's particularity. And the truth is, anybody who's marginal can run into this kind of moment of acute disrespect. You can be gay, you can be Jewish, you can be Catholic, you can be an Arab, a Muslim, and you can run into this moment of acute disrespect. Black people call it the nigger moment, but other people go through this too. And the difference between the black people and the other people is the black people have a history going back to slavery of racial injury with respect to this problem. And so that creates a wound and makes people sensitive and aware, but also vulnerable to further nigger moments, you see. And this is one of the reasons why we don't have the connections that we need between white people and black people in civil society today. I'll stop there, and we can have more discussion later. Thank you.
So we're just going to show those four